Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, so last Monday's program started with Colts offensive lineman Quentin Nelson. Remember that? He scored a TD, he did a keg stand, and then they had the touchdown ripped. You might recall me starting this show last Monday like that. Today's show is starting with another offensive lineman. Titans offensive lineman, Dennis Kelly, scoring and then tossing imaginary beers to his teammates and chugging it. It's awesome.
Fake the handoff, Tannehill, wide open, touchdown, Dennis Kelly, eligible on the play, and it's a big man TD.
Chug it down, big man. And the only thing better than a big man TD. That celebration was awesome, by the way. The only thing better than a big man TD is another big man TD. Check out Bucks defensive lineman Vita Vea. And check him out going, play action, and finding the end zone.
Play fake to Barber and the pass. Touchdown! Vita Vea, the defensive lineman who was lined up in the backfield as a blocker.
He's going to slip Campbell like he's going to block him. Slip him. Go ahead, big guy. You're slippery at 350.
Check it. Vea. Vita Vea. That is not just a fat guy TD. That is a big athletic man touchdown. 6'4". 347. That is the heaviest dude ever to get into the end zone. Let the big dogs eat. I mean, how smooth is that big man? And as long as we're talking about history makers, why don't we talk Frank Gore for a minute? Because with a 6-yard run in the fourth quarter, a Buffalo's 20-3 win over Denver, Gore passed Barry Sanders for third on the all-time NFL rushing list, which really is amazing. I mean, amazing. And you can tell from listening to Frank that it's extremely humbling as well.
When I got drafted in the third round, he said San Francisco reached on me. And after the game, when I saw all the cameras, you know, I was like, man, I passed Barry. You know, Barry, you know, one of the best or probably the best to do it. You know, a guy who they say won't be in the league for 2 or 3 years, man. And I got a chance to pass him today. I'm blessed.
He's blessed, but he's deserving. I mean, that could not happen to a harder working person than Frank Gore. See, to me, Frank Gore is the epitome of a professional athlete. And I stress professional. A guy with an immense love of the game, an obsession with preparation and attention to detail. And while this guy's not done yet, and I know he can still help that team, I, for one, cannot wait to see this dude throw on that mustard blazer. And if he invites me to the induction ceremony, I'm right there. And even if he doesn't, I might still be right there. That's how much respect I have for Frank Gore. That's how much I admire Frank Gore. And I've got more thoughts on him a little bit later on. What an amazing career he's had. An amazing run. And then there's Mason Rudolph, who did not have an amazing week. In fact, he had himself a really bad week and a half. A really bad week and a half. Like the worst week and a half. 4 picks, having his helmet ripped off his own head, and being hit with it by Myles Garrett, a $50,000 fine, and then he capped it all off by getting pulled from yesterday's game in the third quarter after passing for 85 yards and an INT against one of the worst teams ever. Not one of the worst teams in the game today, one of the worst teams ever, the 29 Bengals. That wasn't exactly Bill Belichick turning him inside out. It was the winless Bengals. I mean, one thing to have a terrible game. Another to have a terrible game against Cincinnati. One thing to not be at your best, quite another to be at your worst against one of the worst teams ever. And then to have to watch Duck Hodges come into the game, spark the offense. Thanks, Alvy. Duck Hodges if you need him. And the sad thing is they did need him. They needed him. He comes in, he sparks the offense. He may have even saved their season. And maybe did enough to rip Mason Rudolph's job in the process. So no, I'm not sure there's a guy in the NFL who had a worse week and a half than Mason Rudolph, except for maybe the guy who ripped off Mason's helmet and tried to bash his brains in with it. And as long as we're talking about young starting quarterbacks who may or may not be ready for prime time, how about Dwayne Haskins? All right, that's not fair. He knows how to spell his own name. Dwayne Haskins. Pretty good moment for him, right? I mean, what's sweeter than a young QB getting down with the victory formation for the first time in his NFL career? I mean, that was truly, truly an awesome moment for Haskins. Or it would have been had he actually been there for it, because he wasn't. He missed it because the coaching staff couldn't find him. And the coaching staff couldn't find him because he was snapping a selfie with a fan. Hell yes.
Hell yes.
That is the best. I love that. A man of the people. The game's not even over, and he's off celebrating with the people. Beautiful. I mean, why would anybody else sweat this? Trust me, Haskins himself isn't.
I look up and we're in victory. I said, oh, I thought the game was over with already, but I get it next time.
That's great, dude. One thing, one question. What if there isn't a next time? What if there isn't another win? I mean, you do know you play for the Redskins, right? You do know that you can't play the Detroit Lions every single week, right? It's amazing. I'm not sure what's better. Haskins not finishing the game so he could go off to celebrate with the fans, or the fact that there are actually any Redskin fans left to celebrate with. Either way, I thought it was pretty awesome. But not everybody agrees with me. Not a guy who balled in that town under that very same helmet for years. My man Joe Theismann was not cool with that. Theismann was not here for it, nor was he having it. He tweeted, quote, "How do you miss the last snap of a game because you're taking selfies? That's unprofessional and wrong," end quote. And the fan who was in the pick with Haskins responded with, quote, "Okay, boomer." And the photo of Haskins. Of course it was unprofessional and wrong. Pretty much everything and everyone associated with the Redskins is unprofessional and wrong. My man Joe, of all people, should know that better than anybody. He spent enough time around there. He knows. Unprofessional and wrong. Speaking of unprofessional and wrong, how about the Oakland Raiders? Raider fan, I'm not here to pile on. I'm not here to kill you this morning because I know you're wounded. I know you're hurting. I know some of you are buying the Raider hype in bulk, yo. To the point that you weren't just talking about having a solid season. You were talking about a divisional title. You were talking about not just getting to the postseason, but making a deep run. You were talking about all we have to do is jump on an airplane, take care of those slugs, the Jets. Then we roll into KC, knock the Chiefs the hell out, and the AFC West is ours, baby. I know you were feeling that. I know it. And then came yesterday, 34-3. And not just a 34-3 ass-kicking, but a 34-3 ass-kicking by the Jets. 34-3. Yeah, that'll happen, I guess. It is a long season, and just about every single team is going to nap it out at some point, especially when they're coming from the West Coast to the East Coast. We know all the stats on that trip. But 34-3 to the Jets can't happen. Not with your season possibly hanging in the balance. Not when you're playing for the postseason. Maybe even a divisional title. Raider fans were rolling deep for that game, and they let the Jets hear about it. Jamal Adams heard it, and he was pissed.
I'm not going to lie to you. When we came onto the field, we felt disrespected. We got booed in our own home stadium by Oakland fans, and you know, we came back into this locker room. We went out, and it was a hell of a talk.
Must have been a hell of a talk, because that was a hell of a performance. There was Sam Darnold. Sam Darnold on the ground.
Darnold in the shotgun takes the snap, and Darnold on a keeper up the middle. He's at the goal line, and he's in for a Jet touchdown. Sam Darnold, a little zone read quarterback keeper.
Jets radio. Darnold abusing fools on the ground and then doing it through the air.
Darnold rolls out to his right, looks back to his left, flips it wide open. Ryan Griffin walks into the end zone with a Jet touchdown.
Sweet. And then he did it again.
Darnold takes the snap, drops back, looks left, has time, looks right, throws back in the end zone. It is caught. Robbie Anderson, he's got a Jet touchdown.
My man. Sam Darnold getting nice. Then he found Brian Poole.
First and 10 Raiders. Back to throw. Carr throws one over the middle. It's tipped up in the air and picked off by Poole. And he's going to go into the end zone for a touchdown. Are you kidding me?
Actually, my bad. Derek Carr found him. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper instead. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender, made from real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. And it goes wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach, anywhere. So look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? So Raider receivers were dropping passes left and right as well. They scored on their first drive, then never again. They were down 13-3 at halftime and promptly turned a slow start into a blowout, giving up a TD barely 2 minutes into the second half. I mean, it was bad. Really, really bad. It got so bad, John Gruden pulled Derek Carr to save him. Adam Gase pulled Sam Darnold to rest him. By the end of the game, the Jets were beating the Raiders so handily, we got David Fales v. Mike Glennon. The G-Man was in the house. And no, they did not need to install a skylight to make sure that his head would fit through. Clones, don't go there, don't do it. This is not about some made-up family that does not exist that you want me to acknowledge, that you all keep talking about. There is no family. There is no skylight. Just the G-Man being the G-Man. No, what this is about is not that. This is about the Raiders, an alleged playoff team, getting taken to the woodshed by a Jets team that could barely get the hell out of its own way a few weeks back. Derek Carr said it. We got our butts kicked.
We got our butts kicked, and there's no other way around that. You know, they got after us, you know, from start to finish. Hopefully it's an eye-opener, you know what I mean? Hopefully we take it and we learn from it. Got our face kicked in a little bit, and you try and look forward and be like, hopefully it wakes everybody up.
Man, that was not an eye-opener. That was an eye-closer. These guys are walking out of here with dotted eyes, black eyes. Nobody can see. I thought he did a pretty good job of laying it out, but not as good a job as defensive tackle Jonathan Hankins. He said, quote, "We didn't show up and we got our asses kicked." That's more like it, because that's exactly what happened. They didn't show up and they did get their asses kicked. And then you got Chunk. Chunk went with another ill-advised metaphor in describing this game.
You ever been on a boat that's sinking? It's not happy. It's not pleasant. It's adversity. It's football. You know, you got to respond to adversity. And we didn't do a good enough job as coaches rallying our troops today. And I'm emotional about it. I'm really anxious to get on to the next game and apologize to Raider fans that came out today. It wasn't good enough.
Man, this dude's got me confused once again. Have you ever been on a boat that's sinking? I mean, did you stay on the boat that was sinking? Is this boat sinking? Were you ever on a boat, Chunk, that was sinking? Were you the reason that it was sinking? Look, I understand that hindsight is 50-50. I understand that. But that might be another one of those metaphors that you want back. You might want that metaphor back. I know you want that game back. And you better start grabbing the buckets and bailing, because you do have KC in their place on Sunday. In the meantime, I'm still trying to figure out how the hell you just no-show for any game when you only have 16. But again, I guess that'll happen. Maybe you nap it out once a year. But how do you no-show for a game of that magnitude? Because while those dudes flew to the East Coast, none of them even bothered to get off the bus once they got there. I mean, John, some of Jarrah's metaphors make more sense than that, Chunk.
Circumcising the mosquito.
So, knock on wood. If you're with me, John, you have to do better. You have to do better. Stat. Charles Davis is back. Charles, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. Good morning to you. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family and to everyone who can hear our voices.
You too. Great to have you back. Thanks so much. All right, so you were on that Seattle-Philadelphia game. Let me start with the Seahawks. They didn't exactly play the cleanest game you're ever going to see.
No.
They had 12 penalties, a dropped TD, some other mistakes, but they still found a way to win. It might not have been pretty, but what's it say about Pete Carroll as a head coach and Russell Wilson as a QB if they keep finding ways to win?
Yeah, it says a lot about them, doesn't it? And I know that people look at them and say, well, they're there for the taking each and every week, because going into that game Sunday, Jim, for a team that was 8-2, their point differential for the season was plus 18.
Hmm.
So that tells you every week is just what you described. It's going to be a grind, and they find ways to get over the top. So a lot of people say, well, that's going to run out at some point. But you remember a few years ago, and you know how Pete Carroll is with you know, speakers that address the team, research in the off season, how he does all those different things. Remember the author, Angela Duckworth, and the name of her book, Grit?
Oh, yeah.
That he really latched onto? I think we're seeing a lot of that with this team, you know, no matter what you do, because yesterday I gave Philadelphia's defense a ton of credit for having them hang into that game, right? Because their offense couldn't move the ball at all. So, but the defense kept them in the game. I didn't give nearly enough credit to what Seattle was doing defensively, because Seattle was doing a lot to shut down that offense and not give them any light and any air, even though they're not anywhere close to what the Legion of Boom used to be. But that team knows how to get things done, and the takeaways have increased in recent weeks. And that's a big reason why they're finding ways to win. Because yesterday, as you said, it wasn't clean. It wasn't the normal Russell Wilson magical day. But that team, let's be honest about it. Did you ever feel like Philadelphia really had a chance to win that game? You never felt that way. I didn't care when the score was 10-3. You just kept saying, wow, one mistake away and we could have a tie game. But I don't know that Philadelphia can do it. And yesterday just wasn't their day.
Charles Davis joining us. Not only was Seattle that good and that effective, they did so defensively without Jadeveon Clowney, and yet they still forced 5 turnovers and held Philadelphia to 9 points. So where does that leave the Eagles? They've lost their last two games, 17-10 to New England, 17-9 to Seattle. No shame in losing to either team, but where are the Eagles right now as a team overall?
Major struggle, Jim, and last year, you remember, they went to New Orleans midseason with all those injuries, and they were playing guys in the secondary that I really felt like the next phone call was to you and to me to come in for a tryout. That's where they were. And remember, they got laid waste, 48-7, I believe it was. And they figured out a way to play with those guys, and they found a way to win, 5 out of 6 down the stretch, sneak into the playoffs, won at Chicago, and then nearly won at New Orleans in the divisional round. So I've been, you know, a proponent in these last couple of weeks of saying, hey, don't count out Philadelphia. They know how to turn things around and win. But what I saw Sunday, I don't know if I can stick with that. And here's why, Jim. It wasn't just that they don't have their players. It's that offensively, it is such a slog to try and gain yardage for them. I equated it during the game to trying to play half-court basketball, and I really should have said during the playoffs, during the NCAA tournament, where every set, every call you make, you got to maximize on. I feel like Hubie Brown was calling all the sets from the sidelines and making sure Bernard King got sprung for a shot.
Right.
It was difficult for them. And they have no one to stretch the field, no one that scares anyone. They just sit on every receiver and say, okay, I'm going to sit here about 5 to 7 yards. That's your break point. Do with us what you will. And they don't have guys who can separate. Jordan Matthews can't separate. J.J. Arcega Whiteside can't separate right now. Zach Ertz can, but they're going to, in any key situation, going to be 2 to 3 in his area on him. They just don't have players. So unless Jeffrey gets healthy in a hurry, Aguilar gets healthy and catches the ball in a hurry, it's going to be very difficult for them.
Charles Davis joining us. All right, so they are banged up, and you make that point very clearly. What about Carson Wentz? I mean, there was so much buzz about him coming into the season. He was a potential MVP candidate. How much of this is on him and his decision-making in your mind?
I think some of it is, and he'll have to bear the brunt of that. Look, it's not easy to run what they're doing. And, look, we didn't even get into the offensive line. Lane Johnson didn't play. Brandon Brooks went out, as we found out, with anxiety early in the ballgame. So that right side was decimated. Andre Dillard, a first-round pick, he got replaced because he was having a tough day. So, yes, that's a problem. Jordan Howard's not back there. But he has to bear some of this responsibility. And as a quarterback, you get even more, because there are throws that can be made that he's not completing. And some of that is he's not taking what you're going to give him and just move the sticks, but set yourself up for third down and manageable. Carson likes, one of the things that was attractive about Carson coming out of college is that he did not mind pushing it downfield. But if you try and push it downfield to receivers who aren't getting open, it's hard to do. And we showed yesterday there was one where Miles Sanders is in the flat. He sees him. Nope, that's not enough for me. I want something done. And then he gets sacked. You know, that's the problem that they're running into. Plus, there's some wide open throws. He just airmailed yesterday. That's a problem as well. You got to hit the ones that are available in there. and especially when you have almost no margin for error on offense right now, and Philadelphia's at that stage.
We're breaking down the NFL weekend. Charles Davis back for more. So Philadelphia is, despite all this, Charles, they're one game back at Dallas in the NFC East, and their schedule coming in is really soft. What about the Cowboys? They're coming off that loss to New England after the game. Jerry Jones seemed to be pointing the finger at Jason Garrett. Knowing that relationship, how much pressure is there on Garrett going forward?
Oh, I think a ton now, Jim, because you remember Jerry Jones kind of protected Jason Garrett for the longest time, didn't he?
Always.
You know, never said anything about a coaching change, or when was challenged on that, told everyone how much he liked his staff and whatever. He put everybody in it yesterday, didn't he? He said coordinators, offense, defense, special teams. Obviously, that points to the head coach. I don't think it was an accident that, one, it happened after this loss because they haven't beaten a team with a winning record. And with that roster, you think that they would have that done already. And two, that report that moved that if Jason Garrett lost his gig in Dallas, that he might like the one in New York. Now, where that came from, who said that, where they got, I can't begin to say. I think Ian Rappaport, my colleague at NFL Network, broke it, so I'm not saying it's not accurate because Ian's very good at what he does. But who put that out there in the first place? Who speculated on that? I think that probably stuck in Jerry's craw a little bit yesterday to watch his team lose another one. And again, New England, for the last couple of weeks, they're for the taking, and no one is able to seize on it. Philadelphia couldn't seize it 2 weeks ago. The Dallas couldn't seize it yesterday, and that's a problem for them. So I do think that Jason Garrett now, there is true heat, and remember, he didn't get a new contract this year. He's operating on the last year of his contract.
He is. Charles Davis joining us. All right, so let me keep you in the NFC before you go. San Francisco is now 9-1 after that blowout win over the Packers. I mean, how scary is it if the Niners are putting up that kind of a performance on a night when they're missing a number of key guys due to injury? And you've got Green Bay coming off that bye. They were well-rested. They were ready. They were prepared. And they still put that beat down on them.
They're really scary, and they're so good now on both sides of the ball. And their ability to make adjustments to whoever is in the ball game is something that I'm really admiring about what I'm watching. Because, Jim, you remember when Joe Staley was out at left tackle, Mike McGlinchey was out at right tackle, Weston Richburg was dinged up a little bit at center. They didn't lose a game during that time frame. The first game they lost, remember, they had Staley and McGlinchey back, and they struggled against Seattle. They had to knock the rust off. So this team knows how to adjust and knows how to play and attack. But that defense, I know John Lynch is the GM, not the coach. I know Kyle Shanahan's the coach. But I feel like John Lynch has had a pretty good hand in building that defense. The draft capital on the defensive line, Fred Warner and Quan Alexander, with they brought in to play linebacker, Quan Hurt now right now. But Fred Warner's really stepped up here in his second year. And then in the secondary, getting Richard Sherman the year after the Achilles, and he's back fully. And those safeties are now playing well in Ward and Jaquarski Tart. Doesn't it remind you a little bit in terms of how they built the team? I'm not saying this is what they are, but how they built the team reminds me a little bit of Tampa. DeForest Buckner playing the role of Warren Sapp inside, Nick Bosa playing Simeon Rice at the defensive end, Warner playing the Derrick Brooks role when they run Tampa 2, and then back deep you've got Sherman, you've got Tart and Ward playing the roles of John Lynch and Rondae Barber. They're not those guys, because those guys are amazing, and Simeon Rice is probably an overlooked Hall of Famer, but it's that type of a style, and that's what John Lynch knows well, and he's helping build that team in that image.
Well, I think that's fair. I think that's a good analogy. They may not be those guys, but I think they're in the conversation, and I think that John Lynch has done a masterful job. I think Kyle Shanahan's a genius. I think he literally is a genius.
Jim, if you're trying to match him as a defensive coordinator, and all things being equal, you got a tough time on your hands because he pulls out things and has a fearlessness to his play calling that is beyond admirable. And I'm not saying any recklessness. No, recklessness is more like, you're playing the Madden video game and it's 4th and 88. I'm going to go for it.
Right.
That's reckless. Kyle Shanahan is calculating, but there's a fearlessness with some of the calls that come out and a trust factor with different players. Look, the touchdown pass to Jeff Wilson to beat Arizona, you remember that one?
Sure.
That was called specifically for him. Like, all week long, they thought, this, if we get this kind of coverage, we think we're going to get it. This play's for him. And they put him in the game, anticipating the coverage, got it, and he scores the game winner. Now, before the season, how many people had Jeff Wilson on any type of a fantasy team or just the idea that you even talk about Jeff Wilson? Raise your hands. Yeah, okay, there you go. Amazing.
Before the season, who even knew who he was? Now, we're almost into December, so you're at the part of the season where teams are starting to separate themselves. Who is the best team you've seen so far this season, and what makes them so?
Well, this weekend, we get Baltimore and San Francisco, so we might be seeing the best I've seen coming up. But what I've seen so far, look, I saw New Orleans get whacked by Atlanta, but I still walked away convinced that New Orleans is one heck of a football team because of their defense. I think defense overall is pretty good. I know the last couple of weeks haven't been exactly what you're looking for. But remember, Marshawn Lattimore didn't play, so that hurt you out at the corner. But I think that they are really, really good. And I'm eager to see how that progresses because that NFC is a monster right now. And I'm looking at the Rams and thinking they're still a pretty decent team. Offense is struggling, but the defense is rounded into form. I don't know that they're going to make the playoffs. Okay, the defending NFC champs coming out of the West, because you know that San Francisco and Seattle are going. Can L.A. make that kind of a charge and put them and make them the third team out of the West? It's going to be difficult with their schedule down the stretch.
And, well, much better idea tonight when they take on the Ravens. Great, great matchup. Listen, last thought. The National Football Foundation announced today that you're going to be the MC for the 62nd NFF Annual Awards Dinner.
Yeah.
It's December 10th in New York. Congratulations. How much are you looking forward to doing that?
Thank you, Jim. I'm very much looking forward to it, and what an honor, because you see the people who have come before me who have hosted that. But such great friends at the NFF, Steve Hatchell, who runs the NFF, Matthew Seiden, the CFO of the whole deal, and so many others there, Hillary Jeffries, and right on down, you know, Will Rudd, just wonderful, wonderful people. They do great work in the area of our great game of football. I just love being able to be a part of that and to be able to be there and see so many old friends and so many people I've known, because you remember, Jim, my background was college athletic.
Sure.
So to come up through here and now be able to see everyone in one spot, because it's a reunion every year in New York, and I haven't been able to go to it for a lot of years now, this is going to be a special time for me and a whole heck of a lot of fun. And I can't wait. And one of my really dear friends, Eli Gold, is being honored with the Chris Schenkel Award, and that is just fantastic. Eli and I have worked together years ago, and he's one of my favorites, and he's been a mentor to me along the way.
The Patriots beat the Cowboys. That's not a surprise. Bill Belichick outcoached the Clapper. That's definitely not a surprise. The only surprise was the reaction from Jerry Jones after the game.
We've got a long way to go. With the makeup of this team, I shouldn't be this frustrated.
So he's saying what I said also before that game, that 1-53, Dallas definitely has more talent. But the weak link was the Clapper. And all of a sudden, Jerry Jones, it's like it's finally worked its way back to him. Like he's the last guy to know. I mean, I understand the frustration. Despite the conditions, Dallas could have won that game. You hold Tom Brady to under 200 yards passing and only one TD, you should win that game. But they didn't. And here's what really stuck in Jarrah's craw yesterday.
147 to go. Head-eye snap to Jones. Under the first block. Three's high in the air. Jonathan Jones is there to knock it down. Trying to pick it up. He'll dive on it. Jones has it for the Patriots at the 13-yard line. The ball squirted at three, and regardless, the Patriots will have possession.
Pat's radio, and that set up New England's only TD of the game. Belichick called that play, quote, probably the difference in the game. That's not what Jarrah called it. Jerry Jones did not call it the difference in the game. Jarrah Jones called it coaching. Quote, to me, special teams is 100% coaching. It's 100% coaching. It's strategy. It's having players ready. Special teams is nothing but coaching. Special teams is effort. Special teams is savvy. Special teams is thinking. End quote. Let me translate that for you. Special teams is coaching. Let me recap that for you. Special teams is nothing but coaching. And it's also effort and savvy and thinking. But either way, it's coaching. And either way, that's about as harsh as you're ever going to hear Jarrah when it comes to talking about Jason Garrett. And if you think special teams is all about the head coach, then that was Garrett's masterpiece. There was the blocked punt. There was a missed field goal. There were multiple mishandled kickoffs. The back-to-back penalties when the punt team couldn't get lined up. If special teams is about coaching, and it is, that was a bleeping masterpiece. If special teams is all about coaching, and effort and savvy and thinking. And the Cowboys have none of that. How the hell do you let that guy block that punt? How do you forget about a special team stud like that guy? How do you lose track of that guy? If the clapper was thinking to himself, we're going to make somebody other than Tom Brady beat us, he did. Matthew Slater. And come to find out, Jarrah really does care if they win or lose. I mean, for the longest time, I really wasn't even sure. He really does care if they win or lose. Jarrah's not only about making money. Jarrah's not only about having people look up at him and talk about him. Come to find out, this guy actually looks up at the scoreboard. And then he looks down on the sideline. And apparently, suddenly, he doesn't really like what he sees down on the sideline.
It's frustrating to just be reminded that some of the fundamentals of football and coaching were what beat us out there today.
I mean, I'm not sure if he's being reminded that coaching was what beat them, or if he's only now figuring out what the rest of us have long known, that Jason Garrett just isn't that good. He's just not that good. Because it sure seems like Jarrah is waking up from a long winter's nap on that one. It seems like he went to yesterday's game and watched that team for the first time and thought, holy crap, man, our coach is not that good. Our head coach is the reason we're not actually much better than what we are. Like the dude who owns the team is the last one in the world to find out what the rest of us already knew about the clapper. And yet, there's still more.
When you come into New England on a day like today against this team in this era, and you need to win this to establish what you're about for a season, you've dealt yourself a pretty narrow window to come out of here smiling.
Right, and that window is even more narrow when Jason Garrett is your head coach. Again, with all that talent, and I'm going to say they've got more talent 1-53 than the Patriots, they still have not beaten a winning team this year. They haven't beaten anybody with a winning record. So let me say this. Jason Garrett is not the worst coach ever. I'm not saying that, although a lot of people are. He's not. He's not the worst coach ever. We're not talking Richie Kotite here. I mean, sure, it's easy, and it might even be fun to pile on this guy, but he's not even necessarily terrible. He's just not that good. And they can do better. And he is the biggest reason they're underachieving yet again. The problem is, he'll never be what you need him to be, meaning they'll never get to where they need to go, but the clapper is just good enough not to get fired. Every single year, he does just that one thing he needs to roll it over one more year. And in the meantime, they're never beating anybody that they're not supposed to beat. And part of the reason for that is the clapper will always settle, like he did on 4th and 7 from the Pats 11, down 7, late in the game, when he thought he'd take that chip shot, gimme 3.
And the snap is back to Jones. The placement, swing of the right leg, kick lifted to the uprights is good. So the Cowboys on the board with another field goal. But that's been the extent of the Dallas offense. 3 field goals and a 13-9 New England lead in the fourth.
Well, that was brass, clapper. Did anybody anywhere really think that guy was going to go for it there? Of course he's going to make it a 4-point game with just over 6 minutes left. My man's an Ivy Leaguer, yo. He's going to do that 100 times out of 100. He will always do that. You see, the clapper does not care about your analytics or your numbers. He's going to take that field goal, and he's going to just hope against all hope that the offense will suddenly catch fire at some point, even though it hadn't for the previous 54 minutes. As I said before that game yesterday on the NFL on CBS, that was not about Dak v. Tom. That was about Dak v. Stephon. And Stephon Gilmore was huge, completely shutting out Amari Cooper and coming up with this.
High snap off the hand of Prescott, gathers it in, sidearms to the near side, intercepted by diving Gilmore. A lazy throw by Prescott.
Nice chuck.
Picked off by Gilmore in front of Cooper. At the Cowboy 29.
A sad, pathetic throw by Prescott.
In case you didn't know, that's Pats Radio. A sad, pathetic throw by Prescott. I'm going to take it easy on Dakota. You know what that was? I mean, not the best throw. Sad or pathetic? That's pretty harsh. What that was a great play by a great player. But Amari Cooper is a great player too. And you can't have your best wide receiver getting completely shut out by the opposing team. So do something. scheme something up, coach them up, get things going. But it never happens with the clapper. It never does with that ginger standing up there on their sideline, clapping up a storm. And I'll tell you something else that never happens. The clapper did not wake up to an early morning phone call. Not one informing him that the boss man wants to see him and that he needs to bring the iPad. That didn't happen. Like, I know a lot of you got deked. A lot of you thought, damn, Jera is really pissed. This time, he means it. He's going to do something finally. This guy's raging about the coaches, all of them. He's finally going to break the clapper off. Sure, he's not. I mean, he should, but he won't. And I know this because we have been down this road so many times before. It doesn't matter how many games that Garrett costs them. It doesn't matter how many times he gets turned inside out. He'll still have that job. This stuff just rolls right off him. The underachieving and mismanagement that would destroy any other coach and any other team never, ever touches this guy. And sure enough, there were reports this morning that no changes are going to be made on that staff. Of course not. Like, there may come a time when Jera actually does something and gets rid of his favorite ginger, but I'll believe it when I see it. He should, but he won't. He never does. Climate change could cause the seas to rise 50 feet and turn Arlington into beachfront property. And Jason Garrett will still be clapping his ass off on the sidelines. Yeah, Jarrett says all that and then does nothing. He never does. As far as Garrett settling for the field goal, of course he thought he did the right thing.
Yeah, just to give us a chance coming back the other way, 4th and 7, you know, making a 4-point game. If they go ahead and kick a field goal coming back, you still have a chance to be in the game. And then, you know, would we get it back with just under 3 with a chance to go win it. So just felt good about that decision at that time.
Really? It sounds like you still feel good about that decision. Your offense hadn't done jack for 54 minutes. So what? You were just going to go all the way down the field and win it? When you were already down the field with a chance to tie it? And I'm sure your guys really appreciated the confidence you showed in them on 4th and 7. There's no doubt that guy was not going to go for it. Did anybody anywhere think he was going for it? Any of you Cowboys even think for a second that he was going to go for it?
How about them Cowboys?
Yeah! Come on. Contractors everywhere rely on Ferguson for a wide variety of specialty products, tools, supplies, and services. Access all this and more with the new Ferguson app. It allows you to order on the go, find your nearest location, and quickly scan product barcodes for easy reordering. With tools like this, it is no wonder why ordering with Ferguson is the easiest part of your hard day's work. Download today to get started. Gabe Kapler. Gabe, it's good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, really nice to talk to you, man. It's been a while.
You too, Gabe. So it's been a little more than, actually not even more, but under 2 weeks since you were introduced as manager of the Giants. What have the last few weeks been like for you, Gabe?
It's been a whirlwind. We didn't really have a chance to sit back and digest and absorb the transition because we were on to filling eight coaching spots on our staff. So we've already dove right into searching for a hitting coach, a pitching coach, a bench coach. And I can go on and on. We've been able to and are fortunate to have Ron Wotus back as our third base coach. He's got such an incredible amount of experience with the players on this roster, but also having been through several managers here in San Francisco. So he's been a great resource to me and a support system. And so I'm really excited to have that spot filled. But we have a lot of work to do and getting to know this roster even better and building on the foundation that we already have in place is really, really exciting.
Gabe Kapler is new manager of the San Francisco Giants. Of course, you come into a situation, Gabe, where you're following a legend in Bruce Bochy. A lot of managers might say, I don't want to be the guy who's got to follow the guy. I'd rather avoid that pressure altogether. But this is something you're taking on. What is it about this challenge that excites you, and how do you go about approaching it?
Well, first, let me address filling Bruce Bochy's shoes, which is just impossible. Boch is legendary in this city for good reason. He's established relationships, not just through this organization, but also in the community. He's a guy that I look up to and will lean on as a resource, as as I attempt with a great front office to build a perennial contender in the National League West in the San Francisco Giants. It would be really foolish of me to not lean on him for his expertise, and I will absolutely do that. You know, I guess the reason that I'm excited about coming to San Francisco is because I do believe that the building blocks are in place, but building the foundation, getting in at kind of the ground floor with a group of really exciting young players and some established World Series champion veteran players with track records of success in Buster Posey and Evan Longoria and Brandon Belt, Brandon Crawford, to name a few. I just think the blend of the very young, energetic players and some of the vets who have done it before is enticing, and I have a longstanding relationship with the president of baseball ops here, Farhan Zaidi, and a newly developed relationship with our general manager, Scott Harris, and we're off to a really, really good start as a group. For all of those reasons, I'm excited about being in San Francisco.
We're talking to Gabe Kapler. You mentioned a number of things I want to follow you up on, but let me ask you this. Boch said that he was a better manager the second time around than he was the first time around. You've always been somebody who's looking to learn and looking to improve. So when you look back on your time in Philadelphia, what have you learned that you can bring with you to San Francisco?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I think the experience teaches you many lessons, and oftentimes the lessons come the second time around and you're able to apply them. I think the first thing that stands out to me, Jim, about my time in Philadelphia is how important it is to strike a good balance between instilling confidence and getting every last strategic in-game decision right. So, you know, by way of example, you can't manage this game on paper when you're dealing with players. So if I get a strategic upgrade, or we get a strategic upgrade in the game, at the expense of taking confidence away from a hitter or a pitcher, it might not give you the pop that you think it's giving you. So what I learned is confidence for a baseball player makes a good baseball player. And so a strategic advantage at the expense of taking away confidence is not a prudent decision in my estimation.
I think, Gabe, that to me is a fascinating conversation in and of itself, because, you know, one of the consistent conversations I've had with managers over the past few years is balancing just that, right? The use of analytics and numbers without actually treating players like numbers themselves. So how do you go about doing that? Because if you have that information, you want to take advantage of it, but to your point, not if it's going to hurt the confidence in the player. So how do you balance those two things? How do you make that work?
I think the first step to take is by trying not to, and it's impossible to communicate so effectively that somebody is never caught off guard, but doing your best. So by way of example, if the game plan is to have a starting pitcher come out of the game before he faces a lineup for the third time, that day is not the first time that pitcher should find out about that, right? So it's a conversation in the office. Hey, Aaron Nola, heads up, like, for the last four starts, you've reached 110 pitches. And just a heads up, I'm not letting you get to 95 pitches today, even if you're cruising. So if you've thrown five innings complete, shutout baseball, you're at 95 pitches. For the best interest of you long-term, your health and your well-being, and for the best interest of the club, I'm coming to get you around 95 pitches. I might give you a few more, maybe it's 100 pitches, but I'm not letting you throw 115 pitches in this game. Having that conversation up front involves the player in the decision, ensures that they don't get caught off guard, and makes everybody feel like they're on the same page and pulling the rope in the same direction. And I think that's step one.
That makes sense. And because you play the game, Gabe, for a long time at the high level, that's all you ever want from a manager. Just look me in the eye, shoot me straight, and let me know. But then, like, you consider the rise of analytics and you think about what it was like to be a player when you played versus what it's like to be a player right now. So how much has the game changed?
I mean, I think it changed a great deal. But I think it's interesting. Analytics is never considered to be what you and I thought about when we looked at the back of a baseball card when we were in seventh grade or sixth grade. But the truth of the matter is that was analytics too. So we were kind of just looking at a different set of numbers and a different set of facts to try to predict how good the player would be the next year or the next game or even the next inning. And now we just have a different set of numbers to look through. So that's one of the main things that I see. And then to your point about hitting players directly, telling them the truth, having grown-up conversations with them, and not trying to pull the wool over their eyes. Ultimately, they might not like that conversation in the moment, but they tend to respect it. And I'll give you an example dating back to my time in Los Angeles as the farm director. There were days when we had to make really hard decisions, like release a player or tell him he was losing playing time. He wasn't going to be in the lineup every day anymore. What I found to be really effective is to start the conversation with the information. Hey, today we're going to release you. And then talk about the reasons why that was the right decision for the organization. And what I found is that in the moment, it was very difficult for the player to swallow. But sometimes 1 year later or 2 years later, I'd have a conversation with that same player. And almost inevitably, the feedback that I get is, I really appreciate you telling me the truth, hitting me directly, and not trying to pull the wool over my eyes. So as a manager, I think the strategy is similar. Just tell the players where they stand. Just tell the players what they can expect. And they might not like it, and we don't expect them to like it, but I think they respect the fact that you come at them directly and don't pull any punches about it.
No doubt. Gabe Kapler joining us. You mentioned the Dodgers, so you've been on both sides of this rivalry now. You're new to it with San Francisco, but when you look at L.A., Gabe, I have to imagine that you're more concerned about your team and what you have there. But as you look at L.A., they've had a lock on that division for 7 straight years. You know the challenge you have in front of you when it comes to that. So how do you go about approaching that part of it?
I think by not really thinking, there's not enough time right now to think about what the Dodgers have accomplished over the last couple of years, which is really remarkable. So I don't want to discount any of that, but we just have so much work to do here in San Francisco, from roster construction to improving player development to, you know, taking the players that our amateur scouting department identifies as great athletes and making them the best they can be. And player development does not stop at the major league level. So improving practices, making them more challenging, to make the players' athleticism tick up, also getting them all of the information they need to be successful, putting them in positions to succeed. I just think there's no time to focus outside, particularly in the offseason. Now, that's not to say that when, you know, opening day rolls around and we're facing the other clubs, that we're not going to be relentless about planning and understanding their roster construction and what tools they might use to beat us. But I think right now, staying uber-focused on the San Francisco Giants is the right play.
You know, Gabe, none of this is surprising to me. You and I have talked for a number of years, so I'm not at all surprised to hear you approach it like this. But it really is amazing how different it is now as compared to when you played. Or I can think back in the day when I would talk to managers and they would just kind of spit some old school kind of, I don't know, they'd spin a yarn or maybe give me an analogy or so. This is so analytical. I mean, do you feel like a CEO? Do you feel like a baseball manager? What does the job feel like to you right now?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to take a step back because as a player, like you view the game from a much different vantage point than you do when you're a manager. But I've been in dugouts my whole life, Jim, so that's the place that I feel most comfortable. And I feel, in a lot of ways, like I was raised as an old school player, and you know, I came up in the old Detroit Tigers system that was as old school as it gets. So a lot of that is still in my blood, and I just think that it's not one or the other. You're not an analytics guy or an old school guy. You know, especially if you've been around the game for 20 years plus. Like I came into professional baseball in 1995. Of course, I've failed a lot and I've developed a lot over the years. But one of the things that I've found is I'm not one or the other. I'm not corporate. I'm not like a baseball dirtbag in the cage. I'm none of those things. I am a product of a lot of experiences that give me the opportunity to see the game from so many different angles. And I actually have a hard time with getting when not just me, but other people in the game are put in a box of old school or new school analytics or gut feel, because I just don't think it has to be one or the other. And in fact, I don't think if you are exclusively one or the other, you can be a great baseball leader. So I just want you to know that I don't identify as any one thing.
Quick thought or two, though, on the 49ers. Got to get into that. They beat Green Bay last night 37-8, and I'm still picking my jaw up off the ground because it put my jaw in the ground. That was not a football game. That was, in fact, a nationally televised statement, and the statement is one that San Francisco has been making all season long. Namely, the 49ers are good. The 49ers are real. And as good as you think they are, they're even better than that. I said a few weeks back that there's not a good team that gets less respect than the 49ers. But after last night, that's all changed. Because after last night, what can any critic, skeptic, or even an outright hater have to say about the 49ers now? There are no yeah buts about these guys right now. San Francisco went into last night, and I think that a lot of the country, and frankly myself included, a lot of people were expecting them to slide. A lot of people were expecting them to regress to the mean. Like they had been too hot. And now it's time to cool off, especially against a Packers team that had a week to rest and it played its best football against its best opposition. And then came Green Bay's fifth play from scrimmage.
Gets the snap, five-man rush, now six-man rush. Rodgers is in trouble. Rodgers eludes the rush for a moment, but he's down. Fred Warner finally got him. The ball pops out. It's scooped up by the Niners and down at the two-yard line.
Westwood won on the call. That was the pass rush San Francisco is now legendary for. They get after you, they maul you up front, and then generally they come away with the football. And the 49ers punch it in one play later, as DeForest Buckner said.
Oh, it was a big tone setter. I mean, we came out guns blazing. You know what I mean? That's the kind of energy you want to start off with, and especially with a team like that. And then for the offense to capitalize off of it, I mean, you know, it was just a great start to the game.
It was an amazing start. Seeing that, I was like, oh, damn, look out. That was an insane start for them. And then the rest of the game was like that on a loop. Aaron Rodgers drops back. The Niners secondary doesn't let anybody get free. Rodgers gets hit. Five sacks. One third down conversion. An average of less than 3 yards per play. And it wasn't just the pass rush. It was that Niners secondary. They were hitting. Green Bay had a number of drops early in the game, especially on third down. And I can't say that I blame them if they heard footsteps. Remember, Aaron Rodgers came on the show on Friday. I asked him about that secondary, the defense. He broke it down in great detail. He knew exactly what he was up against. And it still didn't matter. They're that good. All the way. The back end up front. The secondary lays serious lumber. They arrive with bad intentions. If they're not breaking up the pass, there's a chance they'll break your face. If they get flagged for that now, they'll just break you in two. If you had any questions about that defense and about how they handle their business against a Hall of Fame quarterback, they were answered. Because Rodgers was wearing a Niner defensive lineman just about the entire night. And of course, it didn't help that Green Bay lost Brian Bulaga early on. But they needed about 10 of those guys to slow down Nick Bosa, DeForest Buckner, Eric Armstead, and the rest of that crew. You better start remembering those names. Add Fred Warner to that list. Jimmy Ward as well. You know what? Print off the Niners' defensive depth chart and commit it all to memory because they're all that good. And remember, here's the other thing. Here's the other thing about that team and that win. They weren't healthy. They were not healthy. They were so banged up. Kyle Shanahan was talking about how the extra few hours of rest that come with playing in prime time might help them recover. And it did. And I still have no idea how they did it. I have no idea how George Kittle did this.
Garoppolo turns, play action. Rolls to the left side, looking deep. He's got Kittle over the middle, wide open at the 25. Chugging to the 20. Kittle on a diagonal to the 10. Inside the 5 and stretches the ball across the goal line for the touchdown. Welcome back, George Kittle.
How the hell does that guy get downfield like that and make plays like that on a busted ankle and a bad knee when he's not 100% or close to it? Six receptions, 129 yards, and a touchdown on an ankle that had a bone chip that Shanahan compared to bark coming off a tree. And on a knee was something called a popped capsule. Dude, if my ankle is bark that's flaking off, or I've got a popped capsule, much less both, man, I'm lying down and taking a long nap. But Kittle is that kind of monster, and the 49ers are too. And if you didn't know then, you do now. We all do. Brian Harsin is my guest. Brian, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to be on.
It's good to have you on. So listen, before we get to the win over Utah State and what that means, go back to earlier in the week, if you don't mind, and then the moments before the game. You had said afterwards that your team knew exactly what was at stake, who they were playing, and how they had to handle their business. So how pleased were you with how your guys prepared and how focused they were at the task at hand and that they did not let the moment get away from them?
Well, I think that showed up in the game. And they did start. You know, that Sunday we talked about the last game, we put that to bed, and then got right into Utah State. And the challenge is these last two games for us. You know, we're playing on the road. We had a chance to play for a championship. And I thought the guys from Sunday night all the way through Friday had a great mentality as far as their focus, their preparation. And then Saturday morning we did our walkthrough, and usually there's a few words said when we're done, and the energy was right. We brought it up, broke it down, sent them to their rooms, and they came out ready to play. So just proud of our leadership, proud of our team, and certainly the performance we had Saturday.
Boise State head football coach Brian Harsin is my guest. You know, if you're going to go on the road against a tough Utah State team, it sure helps to make a statement early on. Running back George Helani started each of the first three drives with a run of at least 10 yards. How critical was it to get out and get rolling like that?
Well, that was one of the goals in the game, was to run the ball more effectively than we had in the previous games, because we knew the type of team Utah State was just in the run game. We wanted to establish that so we could try to get some throws on the perimeter there, but it really came down to the O-line and the tight ends doing a great job up front. George, our tailbacks, they all ran hard, but I thought our O-line tight ends played their best game, and the run game was effective. We were able to go to it more throughout the game, more consistently. And when you're getting those type of yards early downs, it keeps you out of those third and long situations, which we wanted to be. And so overall, we're proud of our guys. Run game worked well. But really those guys up front, man, they came to play and it showed up in the game.
Brian Harsin joining us. You know, you've scored a TD 84% of the time when you get into the red zone in November, and Saturday included a Statue of Liberty play. Quarterback Jalen Henderson said of running that play, quote, "I felt honored. It's a very monumental play in Boise State history," end quote. You know, for fans around the country, when they think of Boise State, a lot of them think of the Statue of Liberty. So when that play is called, is that special to you as well, or is that just a play that you think might lead to a really critical gain or even a touchdown?
Well, we think the play is going to work. That's why we call it. But Jalen's a senior, and every quarterback at some point in their career will have an opportunity to run that particular play, and it's winding down for him. And we started the week, and he did it, and I told him, hey, you got like a 6 out of 10 on that performance, and then the next day it was a 7 out of 10. So when we scored in the game, he comes running over, and he's like, what did I get? And I'm like, 10 out of 10. And so he was more fired up on that. And that's kind of the game within the game for our players, you know, to be able to do something like that, have a little bit of fun. But more importantly, you know, we're trying to score points, and George did a great job getting the ball in the end zone, and so it all worked out well.
That's so great, right? So the first attempt was a 6, the second was a 7, and then they execute the way they did during the game. Now, you've dealt with some injuries at quarterback, and Henderson stepped in against New Mexico and Utah State. What do you make of the job he's done so far?
I think he's done a great job. I think being in the position he's been for the majority of the season and just preparing and preparing and not playing and preparing, and all of a sudden he gets his moment, and he's shined the last two games. And he's got great leadership qualities. He's very football intelligent. And then his performance on the field has shown him he's a really good player. That's why he's here. And I've just been proud of how he's just handled this entire season. And then when it was his time to step up, that's exactly what he's done. And it's fun to coach guys like that, that are all about the team. And when it's their opportunity, they take advantage of it. And I think the guys around him have really rallied because of who he is and how he's handled himself all the games he didn't play in. And now guys are fired up for his success so far.
Boise State head coach Brian Harsin is joining us. Now, your only loss this season came on the road at BYU in the middle of October. Since then, you have won 4 straight. What do you make of the way your guys have responded to that loss?
Well, we had a bye week after that, which sometimes that's a good and a bad thing. I thought it turned out to be a good thing. It seemed like about 2 months long during that bye week when you're coming off a loss. But I thought the guys went back and really had a lot of self-evaluation on just, all right, what do we have to do as a team, but what do I have to do as a player? What do we have to do as coaches to not let that happen again? And we learned a lot from that game, and I think those guys have really taken that focus, that task at hand, like you said, just every week, and focused on just being 1-0. You know, we talk about you can only win one game a week, and that's the one we're playing in. So we focused a lot more on just what we're doing and preparing ourselves, and they're seeing that process, I believe, work for them so far. And we've got Colorado State this week. We're focused on them, and that's what the task at hand is. And these guys have been doing a good job of getting ready for them.
You know, before I let you go and before I ask you about that, I do want to say the win over Utah State does mean that you'll be hosting the conference title game for the third straight season. I also mentioned off the top that it's the 17th 10-win season in the last 21 years. It can be easy for numbers like that to just roll by and become the norm or to be expected. But how special is it to be a part of this program and know that that is the expectation?
Well, I think that's why guys come here, why coaches want to be a part of this. And it is the expectation, but we don't take it for granted. I mean, it's hard to do that. And every single season, we go back, scrap everything, and start back over like we've never had those type of seasons. And it's what I enjoy, being around guys like that, that understand that process and take it that way to prepare themselves to go back out there, reprove themselves, reinvent, reinvest, and get themselves ready for an entire new season, because you never know what's going to happen. And right now we've been fortunate to win those games. We got to finish, and so hopefully we can win the rest of them.
Brian Harsin, my guest. All right, so you've got Colorado State at their place on Friday right here on CBS Sports Network. How do you go about preparing your team for that particular challenge?
Well, we went down there a few years ago, and we got ourselves behind by about 25 points, and we had to dig our way back out of that, and we won the game at the very end. And so, you know, a lot of these guys were on that team, and we know every week we're going to play and get everybody's best. And so really this week there's no class. It's really just focused on football, focused on getting ready in a shorter week, and going out there and trying to finish the regular season the right way. And we talked about this in January. This has been the goal. This is what we want to accomplish. And we knew that Colorado State was our last regular season game. And these guys haven't really taken that any differently. Focused on what we have to do to be 1-0 this week. We'll get to the championship game after that. And then that's been the mindset, you know, this entire season. And I think our seniors, the leadership, the captains on this team have really held this team in check as far as not getting too far ahead of ourselves, because when we do that, that's when bad things happen. So it's all CSU, it's going on the road, it's winning, trying to win this game and do it on a short week, and that's the focus.
He resides in Buffalo. He is Rick in Buffalo. And unlike Brett and Bugaha, Rick's pretty good at this sport. Yo, Rick, what's up, bro?
It's been a little while, Jim. How you doing, buddy?
Man, I'm so good, Rick. I've never been better. How about you?
I'm doing great. Let me start with one final congratulations on your induction into the Radio Hall of Fame. The place is finally legit again. And thanks to John in New York for scoping every minute of it. Although following Hawk into the bathroom and Elvie into the bedroom might have been a little over the top. Hey, John, there's this thing called personal space, loser. And people really appreciate when you consider it. And speaking of losers, how about all those Patriot front runners getting punked by Gronk last week? How stupid do you have to be to believe Gronk was going back to that hellhole? Nothing better than middle-aged men acting like seven-year-olds who didn't get what they wanted for Christmas. Tears and all. You can grow up anytime now, idiots. And in this season of giving thanks, Jim, I'm extremely thankful Matt in Vancouver finally decided to stop calling in. Turns out he also quit his podcast. Hey, Matt, is there anything in life you haven't quit? Maybe it's time you quit that too. Actually, don't. Stick around so I can keep clowning you for another couple decades. And I'm sorry to report this, Jim, but I gotta take a rain check for Thanksgiving dinner. My old man's going to be in the shop for a few more days. But thankfully, with all my connections, he's getting the best of care. And he'll be running better than ever in no time. Get well soon, fat boy. War the Bills spoiling Thanksgiving for all those deadbeats in Dallas. War Frank Gore being just like me. Underrated, underappreciated, but a first ballot Hall of Famer. Thanks for the vine, Jim. I'm out.
Rock him. That's all fair. That's all fair. Rick in Buffalo. Rick, you are just like Frank Gore. Underappreciated, underrated, and a lock for the Hall of Fame.
Good night now!